Dr. Henry Steele Commager and his guests, Mrs. Leland Hazard, member of the Board of Education of Pittsburgh, and Dr. John Geis, Dean of the College of the University of Pittsburgh.
Professor Commager, in this country, we seem to want everybody to go to college. In England, they manage quite differently and are very selective. Now, our colleges are often compared unfavorably with English colleges in their achievement and their scholarship.
Yes, especially by the English, Mrs. Hazard. I know over and over again in England, the English would say, well, you know, a typical English boy who's gone to Eton and King's College, Cambridge, is well ahead of a typical American boy who's gone to Clinton High School in Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. And this proves the superiority of English education, which it doesn't necessarily prove. Whatever may be the validity of the English position, it does seem to me that it's no use trying to apply.
Wouldn't we solve many of our problems
standards.
If we did that?
I don't think we'd solve our problems. We'd merely create a social crisis and perhaps an intellectual crisis in our country. Ours is a different system with a different tradition, and we have to operate within the American tradition and on the American practices. We are committed, for better or for worse, and I'm firmly convinced it's for better, to the theory of a democratic educational system, and to the theory, too, that the potential abilities of the young are pretty much even, are pretty much average out through the whole of society. We very much doubt that there is such a thing as a true intellectual elite, but believe that vast numbers of our people are capable of just about as much education as we can give them, and I see no real reason to doubt that. Whatever may be the validity, however, invalidity of a thesis of that kind, I think it's absolutely impractical to discuss whether we should or shouldn't adopt the English. We can't adopt the English system or the French system. We've got our own, and society simply wouldn't tolerate the creation of an educational elite which left the overwhelming majority of American youngsters out in the cold.
Well, Mr. Commager, despite the theory, won't it be necessary? Isn't it necessary for us to give the sort of training that might be called that of the intellectual elite?
I think we have to give that kind of training, but I think we have to give it to as many people as possible, not just to an intellectual elite. I think the problem that confronts us is not the rather easy problem of separating the intellectual sheep from the intellectual goats by IQ tests or other things of that kind. I think the problem is that of lifting the whole level of education, secondary and above all so-called higher education, to those standards of which we are capable, of which we've shown ourselves capable. I think the great danger that confronts our society today, and especially our education, in the face of vast flood of students who are coming on to the high schools and the colleges and universities, is the danger of leveling down instead of leveling up, of a deterioration of the intellectual content of education. And along with that, and in part a product of that, the great danger is the creation of a class education, of a class system in education, whereby there is an elite, financial or educational, to which we make available a really first-class education at every level, and where we allow the vast majority of our young people to get a second-class education.
You mean by that that there would be certain colleges where we would provide for an intellectual elite?
Clearly, we wouldn't deliberately do that, but whether we do it deliberately or do it by the natural course of development is equally dangerous. The situation we face today is that a number, especially private universities, colleges and universities, that are in a position to select their cat students, unlike the state and municipal institutions, which for the most part cannot select. The private institutions are in a position to select their students. They do select, therefore, the cream of the crop. They are in a position to maintain very high standards. They do train for the graduate schools and the professional schools. And they may, without willing to do so, they may create an educational elite. so that you get a first-class education at Harvard or Princeton or at Amherst or Williams or at Oberlin or Carleton or something of that kind, and a second-class education at the state and municipal institutions, which are not permitted to select their students, are not permitted to maintain standards, and which, for a variety of reasons, are not able to create the kind of atmosphere, intellectual atmosphere, so tremendously important in establishing those standards, in establishing respect for learning. And I think one of the gravest dangers that confronts our society today is this danger of the creation of a class system in education, such as the English have for a long time had, where your favorite classes go to the good set public schools, as they call them, Winchester, Westminster, Rugby, or Harrow, and to Oxford and Cambridge, and where the rest of society goes to the so-called provincial colleges and universities.
Well, isn't there another danger involved here? You speak of class education, but isn't it necessary for us to see to it that the bulk of the students are able to understand what those who go to the chosen universities are doing?
It's necessary, of course, that we educate as many people as possible and maintain levels as high as possible at all stages, above all the secondary. And I might ask some questions or answer some questions on this relation of the problem of secondary education to higher education later on, if time permits. I think the problem, obviously, is not one we can isolate in the colleges and universities. The notion that we can single out higher education and study it in a vacuum and arrive at reforms in a vacuum is a notion born of folly. Education at every level, but above all, so-called higher education, is a function of society and inevitably mirrors a kind of society. What is essential, if we're going to prepare a body of citizens competent to deal with the tremendously complex problems that have come up, problems that require far more patience, far more understanding than were required in the 19th century, what is essential is revolutions in society itself, revolution in the attitude toward education, the attitude toward students, the attitude toward scholars and scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first revolution, if that isn't too large a word, is in the attitude toward the concept of education. I said education is really a function of our society. Normally you get the kind of education society wants.
But that's true historically, certainly.
This is not a closed product. Society wants the kind of education it's taught or persuaded to believe it ought to have as well, so that the colleges and universities have a very important responsibility in instructing society on this matter of the nature and function of education.
Now, Professor Cumminger, if society gives the colleges a different kind of opportunity, for example, if state universities are allowed to be selective, then what specifically happens in the college itself that raises the level?
Well, a great many things have to happen. As I say, they have to start happening in the home.
Yes.
They have to start happening in the society, in the willingness to realize that the colleges and universities are doing an intellectual job, not a social job. They have to start with the realization that the intellectual content of education is important and the non-intellectual content, the athletics, the fraternities and sororities, the college functions of various kinds are for the most part secondary, they're trivial. And our society hasn't arrived at that yet. We do not, as a society, appreciate the intellectual function of our institutions of learning. We require that they do a great many things that they have no business doing. A great many communities, for example, expect that local universities provide them with football entertainment or with basketball entertainment. Mm-hmm. Now, there's logically no more reason why Pittsburgh, for example, or Pennsylvania should provide the citizens of their community with football entertainment then why Bryn Mawr or Vassar should provide the citizens of their communities with nightclub entertainment. Their job isn't to entertain the public. Their job is with learning. Their job isn't to join fraternities or to carry on fraternity functions. Their job is with learning. Society has to come to the point where it realizes that if you're going to have a first-rate education, you have to let the students and the faculty and the whole community concern itself with the excitement of learning and with enlarging the frontiers of knowledge all along the line, and put athletics and put miscellaneous activities in their mm-hmm. place. There is a place for them, mm-hmm. but the place is a secondary place.
Well, Mr. Commager, I'm very much interested in what you just said, that logically there's no reason why a university should provide these things. And I certainly agree. But traditionally, they do that, and they have been doing that for many generations.
No, I think not, sir. I think the athletics, for example, is rather a modern development. Not until the 1870s or 80s did the colleges and universities take athletics seriously. Right. Not until the 20th century do we have the period of the great stadia and the paid coaches and the rest of it. The fraternities, too, are on the whole a fairly modern yes. development, and many of our institutions still do not have them. I think the tradition rather in the 18th and 19th centuries was more of an intellectual tradition than it is at the present day, and that's quite natural because in the 18th and 19th centuries, on the whole, those who did go to colleges and universities did represent something of an intellectual elite.
Yes.
Now, we're talking about the students who went to colleges and universities, and I think that's the second thing that has to be emphasized far more than it has been. We need indeed a revolution in our thinking about students and in thinking by students. If society is going to regard college and university students as grown-up children, they will act like children. If society will regard them as young adults, they will act like adults. The young are under tremendous pressure to do what is expected of them. If they're expected to make themselves silly at football rallies, they will make themselves silly at football rallies. If they're expected to enjoy Bach, they will enjoy Bach. They generally do what's expected of them. Society in this country expects them to be children. We coddle our young. We want to be sure they're not exposed to any dangerous ideas before they get out and have to vote. The result is they haven't any ideas when they get out and have to vote. We want to be sure they don't join dangerous organizations. We want to be sure that they don't grow up too fast. We should take just the opposite attitude, that we want them to start growing up when they go to college and to act like young adults, to concern themselves with things of the mind. And this requires also a different attitude on the part of the young themselves.
I'm wondering if it has anything to do also with our coddling of them, that we depend so much on the lecture system.
Hear,
still.
Hear. That is part of the whole...
coddling, isn't it, really?
Well, I think not only the lecture system, but the required courses and the required attendance and the examinations. I'd like to see all of it thrown out of the window, at least from the second year of college and university on. Most of it is in the field of non-essentials. Most lectures are merely substitutes for what could be read in the library. And the whole machinery of the organization of student life is on the whole absurd. Oxford and Cambridge don't do it. Paris and Berlin and Rome don't do it. They've been at the job of education rather more centuries than we have, and their students can manage without this kind of coddling, without required courses and the rest of it. American students can do the same. The students themselves have much to answer for here. If the students expect to be treated as young adults, they must start acting as young adults and take on responsibility for themselves. And one of the great problems of education in America is, I think, that of realizing that the main job of education is performed by the students. I'm deeply persuaded that you can't teach very much, but that you can learn a great mm-hmm. deal.
Right.
Our confidence in teaching seems to be one of the most misguided aspects of American life. We think you can give a lecture on something and the students know it, or teach philosophy, and then people say, I had a course in philosophy, or I had history. But the only thing you learn is what you learn yourself, and you learn on the whole from each other. You learn from libraries. You learn from living. You learn from those intangible and atmospheric things. The great thing is to create the kind of intellectual community where intellectual activities are important, to create the kind of community where the students learn to respect men of learning, men of science, men of scholarship, men who know that the most important thing in the world is to expand their own particular frontiers of learning, communicate something of that contagion of excitement to the young. And the young can get more excited over learning sonnets or learning something about astrophysics than they do over football games, if it's put to them properly, and if the atmosphere is one to convey that excitement to them.
Well,
so
sure.
The second revolution is this revolution with the young.
I was going to say that certainly there are many men, there are many campuses where men do create that interest, where they have that atmosphere. But the problem is, as you were saying, to do that for all of the students on any campus.
You touch now...
It becomes quantitative.
Can you do it in all directions?
I'm one of the most difficult of all our problems. Yes. We're going to try to educate 5 or 6 million students. We haven't at present enough first-rate scholars to educate 3 million students. Great question arises, how are you going to educate 6 million without letting the whole educational level drop to the high school level? I don't think there's any easy answer to that, but I think there are partial solutions. One partial solution is a revolution in the attitude toward scholars, toward the whole business of scholarship, one which will give a greater prestige to scholarship and attract more first-rate minds into it. Another is to realize, as I said, that there are many things that are learned that can't be taught, and that scholars don't have to teach everything. I think one of the great illusions of American education is that every institution of learning has to teach all subjects, that every department has to cover the whole ground from Hammurabi to the Supreme Court, or from the Anglo-Saxon literature to Thomas Eliot, or whatever it may be. No other institutions in other countries are under this illusion that they have to teach a course on every field of chemistry, or every field of literature, or every field of philology. And we don't need to. We do far too much teaching. We expect to cover far too much ground in courses. We rely far too little on libraries. We rely too little on the students themselves. I think if you released scholars from much of the burden, the useless and futile burden of inculcating elementary facts, to the task of pursuing learning and exciting the young to follow learning, you'd be on your way to solving this problem of where to find enough. You can't find enough scholars to do the job, but you can reduce the number required to do the job. You can also put a great deal of the money now used on athletics, now used on administrative routines, on the job of scholarship. We don't need to keep attendance records. We don't need to give course examinations. We don't need to do many of the administrative things we do. And we don't need to have paid coaches or build stadia. Other universities and other countries don't do these things. And they have more athletics at Oxford and Cambridge than they do at Harvard or Columbia or Yale. More people are engaged in them.
With this matter of having professors specialized in certain scholarly fields in certain universities also mean specialized libraries, and would we come to a point, for example, where we would make use of our easy ways of transportation now actually to transfer students for specific study?
Two things are involved there, Mrs. Hazard. One is we're already on the way of solving the libraries confronted by this impossible problem of having material and everything, have begun to work out allocation of material. They don't, Columbia and New York Public, Princeton and Yale don't all duplicate. They've got a working agreement about what they will specialize in. The other is very important, that it's lots cheaper and lots better to take the student to the library or the university than to duplicate facilities all along the line. Instead of every institution trying to teach classical archaeology, it's cheaper to send students to the two or three institutions that do a first-rate job and that have all the journals and all the facilities. And so too with almost all fields. We can't all have Near Eastern institutes, Middle Eastern institutes, and Far Eastern institutes, as we appear to be trying to have. What we must do is build up a few strong ones. In short, what we must do is what the Rockefeller Foundation did some years back under Mr. Flexner's leadership. confronted with very low standards in medical education in the United States, Flexner decided the thing to do was to establish half dozen medical schools so good that all other medical schools would have to come up to that level or go out of business. And by wise support of key institutions in key regions of the country, he did precisely that. And I think we will have to come to that in the field of many specialized fields, and also with respect to libraries. Mm-hmm. All our libraries can't be good in all subjects. It's absolutely impossible.
I'm interested in this idea. Everything that you have said about the need for change seems to be postulated upon that change originating in the society, in our society, in order for the schools, both secondary and of higher type, to develop. You said that in commenting on athletics, that the present system, the present interest in athletics, is only 80 years old. Goes back about 1780.
In some ways.
That's a very long time in the formulation of a tradition, an effective tradition. And we have spoken also of these other aspects of present-day education. They, most of them, reflect the interests of American society, the attitudes of American society. Now, granted, we need these changes. How are we going to go about getting them?
The question of social change is, as you know, one of the questions that tantalizes the sociologists and the behavioral scientists more than almost anything else. How do you bring about social change? Nobody quite knows. But certainly, we can't assume that we have a static society. There are no changes. We brought about changes in the past, and some of them undesirable changes. One thing I think we need desperately is a kind of educational leadership, educational statesmanship, that I think we had more fully a generation or two ago than we have now. I think most of most observers would agree that we have very few of the great educational statesmen that we had in the days of Harper of Chicago, Eliot of Harvard, Gilman of Hopkins, for example, or outside the presidency, educational philosophers like John Dewey, for example, or like Vincent of Minnesota, who founded the Chautauqua. Mm-hmm. Great figures who think constantly of the problems of education. Whatever view we may take of Hutchins' particular reforms, he was at least an educational statesman who concerned himself continuously with the great philosophical questions of the nature and function of education. I think many of our educational leaders have been derelict in their job of educating the public, of educating state legislatures, of educating regents and boards of trustees. I take as a fundamental principle that our society is intelligent and well-meaning. Nobody in America is against education. Nobody wants ill for the universities. Even trustees and boards of regents that make what are to my mind calamitous mistakes don't do so out of ill will, they do so out of confusion. And I think our university president and our professors as well have been derelict in failing to undertake the job of educating these decisive groups in American society about the nature and function of education. And in educating society itself, we have to bring home to society the absolute, the inescapable necessity of training a generation able to deal with the kind of problems that are coming up. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're not doing that, that we're educating down instead of educating up in many of our high schools and our colleges and universities. I don't for a moment think this task is a hopeless one or a desperate one. We've performed something like miracles in the past in the realm of education. We were the first country to undertake universal education. We were the first country to educate girls. We did things over and over again that other people thought couldn't be done, and we managed to do them. We're richer now than we were before. We've had more experience than we've had before. I'm convinced we can do what has to be done if we know what has to be done. And if we're giving the guidance and leadership, I think American opinion will rally to the highest standards and the highest levels that are presented to them.
Well, is the place of major emphasis the institutions of higher education or the secondary schools?
The place of major emphasis is both. I don't think they can be separated, sir. We have to start in some ways in the secondary schools, and I'm persuaded that the secondary schools generally can do a much better job than they're doing. And I put that on the most elementary conceivable basis, namely that, let us say in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, whose societies are very much like our societies, whose youngsters are neither wiser nor less wise, whose youngsters are very much like our youngsters, a Dane in Denmark and a Dane in Wisconsin, a Swede in Sweden and a Swede in Iowa are pretty much the same. They do in their secondary schools the kind of thing we do in most of our colleges. If they can do it, we can do it. Not only that, I go further and say that our crack prep schools represent not really an educational elite. They represent a selected group, to be sure, but selected to some extent on financial grounds. And the youngsters there can rise to whatever is expected of them. I don't see any reason why we can't establish educational levels generally comparable to those that are maintained at our good preparatory schools or at some of the remarkable high schools that you find scattered all over the country, in New York City, I'm sure here in Pittsburgh, in Omaha, and various places. There are high schools with great traditions that maintain high standards, and the students almost always live up to the standards.
May I ask a question about that? It interests me very much. And I'm wondering if you're thinking, when you're talking about a big city like Pittsburgh, in terms of specialized high schools like the Arts and Music High School in New York or the Brooklyn Technical High School, are you thinking of a completely unselected group in high school?
I think there's room for both of these. One of the great virtues of our system is that we're so large, there's room for pluralism. And I'm all in favor of the selected high school and also the large non-selective high school. I think, in a way, I yield to you here because this is your special interest. In a way, many of our educators are still going along on the 19th century assumption that the primary job of the schools is to adapt to heterogeneous society and make it homogeneous. It's my persuasion that we've done that job to a large degree, that we're no longer under the tremendous compulsion to do the non-educational job, and that now we are in a position to undertake the educational job. Now, at last, we are in a position to concentrate on the really important things, which is training the minds and the spirits of the young, rather than teaching them to get along and resolve their problems of inheritance or their problems of race or their problems of color or their problems of cultural background.